The Angie's List you know and trust is now Angie, and we're so much more than just a list. We still connect you with top local pros and show you ratings and reviews, but now we also let you compare upfront prices on hundreds of projects and book a service instantly. We can even handle the rest of your project from start to finish. So remember, Angie's List is now Angie, and we're here to get your job done right. Get started at Angie.com. That's A-N-G-I, or download the app today.
Achieving a gorgeous grin from home isn't a total mystery with BiteClear aligners. Just don't be surprised if all of your sleuthing friends start asking, "What's your secret?" Begin by ordering your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95. BiteClear aligners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces. Plus, they offer flexible financing, accept eligible insurance, and you can pay with your HSA FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
Hi, everybody. Welcome to another episode of Martinis and Murder. And today is a really fun episode. We talk to all kinds of true crime experts from all over the industry. And today we have former reporter to the Los Angeles Times, Jeff Boucher, joining us. Jeff, welcome to the show.
Thanks, John.
So Jeff is, first of all, let's get this right out of the way. Jeff is a gin and martini guy. So he's very welcomed on our show. But Jeff, unfortunately, because of COVID-19, we don't have any martinis to deliver. Although now that I'm thinking about it, maybe we should start delivering something like that to our guests. Would you have been like appreciative of that if we delivered you one?
I'll wait at the door.
Yeah, so maybe that's something we'll do in the future, but so you'll have to come back. But Jeff, thanks for joining. You are featured in Oxygen's upcoming show, The Real Murders of Orange County, which premieres Sunday, November 8th at 7 p.m. on Oxygen, so you guys listening have to go watch that show. I saw the first episode. Jeff, you were very involved in the reporting and, I don't know if you would say the investigation, but maybe, of the crime that occurred in episode one. Can you tell us a little bit about, like, what happens in this episode? You don't want to give away too much, but give us a little brief understanding of what to expect in our first episode and what your involvement in it was.
Sure. So this is a crime that takes place in Orange County. And, of course, you know, what Orange County represents to a lot of people, it's, you know, where the land meets the sea and where affluence meets ambition. You know, it's a lifestyle that's epitomizes Southern California in a lot of ways. Mm-hmm. And this series and then this first episode take a look at when the American dream in this city, in these cities by the sea, when they go the wrong direction and then right. turn into something else. And the first one is about Jane Carver. Yeah. And her death came to represent something larger than the incident itself. It became a part of the local landscape, and it really affected life in yeah. Orange County for quite a while. And it was a kind of a mystery of whodunit, one of those yeah. kind of mysteries. And I was a crime reporter at the time for the LA Times.
Yeah, I'm curious about that because, I mean, I'm kind of jumping ahead a little bit to my bigger thoughts about media in general, but so are you still a crime reporter, or were you just a crime reporter back then?
I'm not a crime reporter now, per se. I'm a freelance journalist now. At that time, I was a staff writer at the LA Times, but yeah. I covered crime and law enforcement for about 6-7 years, in the 90s.
Got it.
For the Times. And then I stayed at the paper for another 14, 15 years doing other things. I did politics oh. and entertainment. I became the rock and roll writer for the calendar section.
Yeah, we're going to get into your podcast too in a second. So don't worry. We'll get into your rock and roll podcast. But so to the crime reporting, one of the things that really stuck out to me, I mean, obviously this show and this case in particular had so many twists and turns. I think the one twist for me personally was in the show that airs on Sunday, you said you heard about the case listening to the police scanner. Yeah. Was this something, I mean, technology, especially today, is so huge, especially when it comes to resolving a lot of these kind of murder investigations. Can you explain to listeners who might not even know what a police scanner is, like what that process was like to sort of just sit by a police scanner and wait for a big crime to happen? And plus, I would assume there weren't a lot of these types of crimes happening in OC, right? Or am I wrong?
Well, you know, it's well, to answer the first, the first question.
Lots of questions. Sorry.
Scanner. Oh no, no problem. Yeah, the scanner. It's a classic fixture of being a breaking news crime reporter at a major metropolitan daily newspaper, as they say. I had a scanner in those days on my desk, and that would have been about the size of like a desktop adding machine for people that remember those, or you know, probably about the size of a small printer these days. And it would pick up the frequencies of all the radio communications between all the law enforcement agencies and emergency personnel, and as well as some aviation and military stuff as well. The Times, like other newspapers and other TV stations covering law enforcement and, you know, breaking news in those days, would monitor those broadcasts and learn the codes, because they speak in a code shorthand. You know, you learn what you know, everything means, like code 4 versus code 2, and like whether you should be excited or nervous. And and I had also a scanner, a handheld scanner, and also one in the company car. There's a couple of cars that we use, and then the photographers would have them as well. And it was not uncommon for, you know, in the newsroom, you'd be working, but you always had your ear to the scanner. You kind of, it's like in the background, and you kind of catch certain codes and things that jump out at you. But there was more than a few times where I would be in my car or at my desk and hear something, and actually get there while it was still happening, just because of the nature of things. That I remember distinctly that happened. That happened with the Carver case. And also I remember it happened with a shooting at the Caltrans maintenance yard in Garden Grove. And I was very close by and actually got there while the shooting was still going.
Oh my gosh.
Which gives you the really surreal experience of being the only person that's running toward the shooting that doesn't have a badge or any apparent Kevlar.
Exactly. Wow, yeah, that's definitely very unique, a very unique scenario. Whenever you heard about the Jane Carver case come over the scanner, were you surprised? Like, what was the sort of, I guess, what was the atmosphere of Orange County at that time? It seemed like this was a rare circumstance.
Yes, it certainly was a rare circumstance. I mean, Orange County is a large and deceptively complex metropolitan area. It's not as nearly as homogeneous as people perceive it. I mean, at the same county, you have Huntington Beach and Newport Beach. You have the coastal cities like that that are well-known and famous. But then you also have, it's Anaheim, which is home to Disneyland and to sports teams. And then you have Santa Ana, which is the county seat and the most populous city in the county, and also the one with the most entrenched crime challenges historically. And the county's more diverse in its demographics than it was certainly in the 60s and 70s, when it was more homogeneous and closer to the perception that probably people have of kind of the Tony affluent and largely white communities that kind of define that area and the politics of that area. So this crime took place in Fountain Valley, and Jane Carver was a former flight attendant and was jogging and in a neighborhood in Miles Square Park where this would be, and even today would be, an aberration. And it's one of the reasons that it really seized the attention of people. It you know, you always hear, I would talk to people in neighborhoods like this when there would be a crime like this, and you would inevitably hear, this isn't supposed to happen here. This is not where this happens. This isn't the what happened, you know? And of course it isn't until it does. And then, it's seized the attention of the media and of law enforcement and of the community, for sure.
I was just going to say, one of the things that really stood out to me, to your point that you were just making, was in the show, and this isn't giving any of the details away for you guys listening, but in the show, one of the kind of notes was that the community came together to find the person who killed Jane Carver, and the community was bigger than the police force. And I thought, wow, that's quite a statistic, I guess. She seemed to be beloved, and the community maybe so shocked by what had happened that they had no other option than to join forces to try to find her murderer, right?
Yeah, John, that's right. And in addition to that, because of her her career and mm-hmm. her personality and the different things that she did outside of work that she did in the community and for good causes, all those things have made her someone who was very hardwired into mm-hmm. People's lives. So right. when this happened, it was a real rupture for a lot of people. And there were, you know, a meeting of flight attendants that came together, and there was, you know, scores and scores.
That's
of
right.
I think that speaks to Jane's impact during her life.
Yeah, totally. Tragically, she was shot and killed just feet away from her front door. I thought the show did a great job of sort of showing the perspective of, like, literally where she was shot versus the door. I mean, it's literally feet away.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm assuming that with crime being so rare in this type of way back then, by the way, this was in 1995, I want to say.
That's right, yeah.
Yeah. Was that rare in your investigations to have something like this happen, like, literally at the front door? You know, like, I'm just trying to figure out, like, how often this type of murder was happening.
Right. Surprisingly, people tend to get, if people get murdered, they tend to get murdered either in their workplace or in their home, or near one of the other,
as opposed to
random kind of, like, you know, the perception that I think when people see you see, like, first day TV news reporting of a crime and there's no details and you just see a tarp on the ground, you know.
Exactly, yep.
And, you know, the reporter says, you know, there details are few tonight, and so you don't know what that is, you know.
Right.
But once you dig into the statistics and look at it closely or closer, what presents itself is that the completely random stranger on stranger murder is not as common as the murder by someone that knows you. Most people
right.
are killed either by a parent, by their parent, their sibling, by their child, by their relationship, by their coworkers. They're typically killed by someone that has a stake in their life, and a grudge or an emotional, kind of beef.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah, now that you say that, I think, you know, we've done like 200 some episodes of this podcast, and you're mm-hmm. absolutely right. I don't know what I was thinking just then, because the statistics of our show.
Well, it's because I think it is because of that perception of the TV.
No, you're
news,
right.
You know,
I
think that lingers, that, you know, the idea of, like, oh my God, you know, what's going on tonight? And you have to think, too, as a community like Los Angeles County, there's 14 million people, you know, so, like, every day, if you watch the news and you see six murders, it feels like it's the end of the world, and it's terrible, but you have to think about it. Like, that's really in the grand scheme of things.
Hey, I'm Jamie.
And I'm Justina.
And we're the hosts of Just So You Know, a podcast where we get to the bottom of suspicious stories and outright lies we're being told by companies that profit off of animals.
You think Elon Musk is shady? Wait until you hear our episode about his sinister brain experiments.
First he ruined Twitter, now he's coming for your actual brain.
No.
We've also got one about that time I stormed the runway at New York Fashion Week to protest Coach's leather handbags.
Yeah, I heard they weren't happy about that.
I couldn't tell you. They're not talking to me at the moment.
And we're just getting started. In the coming weeks, we're going to blow the lid off of everything from shady pet dealers to monkeys held hostage by coconut milk companies to the astonishing secret behind the no animals were harmed message you see at the end of movies.
And so much more. We'll hope you join us for this surprisingly fun journey full of strange characters, secretive companies, and a whole world of stuff they really don't want you to know.
Subscribe to Just So You Know wherever you get your podcasts and look for our new episodes every Thursday. Just So You Know is a PETA production.
CarMax is putting peace of mind back in car shopping by putting you in the driver's seat to find a ride that's right for you.
Because at CarMax, we believe you shouldn't just settle for a car. You should love your car. That's why every car we sell is CarMax certified quality, so you can be sure with upfront pricing that's the same for every customer. So don't settle. Find love at first drive and start shopping now at CarMax.com. CarMax, the way car buying should be.
I love that you're saying this, actually, because my mom and I were just having this conversation about New York City, where I live. And, you know, when things like random things happen, someone's driving through Times Square and it's horrible, terrible, of course. But to people that don't live in New York City, they don't realize, you know, there's however many people are living in millions by the millions. So one little thing like that, when it comes to the day to day, isn't that significant. You know what I mean? So,
right.
You know, I try to like put it into perspective for my family that doesn't live there and doesn't understand the per capita rate.
Yeah. And well, you know, and there, during those 6-7 years that I covered crime, I can tell you that, you know, I became very sensitive to this topic because I would, I would meet people who were terrorized, quite honestly.
For sure.
They had,
yeah.
You know, fear for their lives and things. And we have to remember is that 1993 was the peak year for murder in the United States.
Oh.
It was number one for the state of California. It was number one for Los Angeles County, number one for Orange County, and number one for the country.
Wow.
And, you know, I was a 24-year-old crime reporter kind of in the middle of all this. And what I can tell you is that when I came out the other end, I realized that I felt kind of, it's a paradox, I suppose, it was safer.
Because
I knew that, you know, if you aren't, like, if you look at all the murders, and this is not to be, to put a value on any murder versus another one, obviously, you know, it goes without saying the moral implications of that.
Of course.
As far as risk, if you are not, you know, a security guard, convenience store clerk, law enforcement officer, gas station attendant, you know, overnight. Okay, those careers, or like if you work with, if you're working an armed car, you know, things like that, those are careers that are going to have a higher level of risk. If you take those out and then eliminate people that, if you eliminate the cases where someone was killed by their relative, and then eliminate the cases where someone was killed by someone they knew, you get down to you're down to like 11-12% crimes that are left that are really just the kind of random things, or, you know, a mistaken identity, or, you know, someone that was shot in a drive-by that was unintended, things like that.
Yeah.
But it's not the perception that people have, but it is the reality.
Yeah, I mean, that's such a great point. I mean, there's, especially with media, and I think that's my next question to you. I'm curious how you have approached media over the years, and its part in murders and investigations. But so much of media is people sort of absorbing what, you know, is a true factual, you know, news report, but then maybe internalizing it or projecting some kind of bigger issue potentially, you know, in terms of like being scared about neighborhoods, or, you know, sadly we see a lot of race relations these days as it pertains to that kind of stuff. So yeah, it's very interesting. How do you look at media versus, you know, in the early 90s when you were a young 20 something getting into crime? Do you think that the media's sort of involvement, and even in the true crime genre, I mean, look at Oxygen, look at this podcast, I mean, there's a whole genre of people telling these stories back to the public. What are your thoughts on the way media has played a role in true crime today versus back then?
It's an interesting question, and I'll tell you, is you picked an interesting person to ask, because I have some personal history too. Like, while I was covering, like I said, 1993 was the peak year for murder in the country. And at that time, I was covering crime in Orange County, California, for the LA Times. But that year, my sister was murdered.
Oh, wow. I'm so sorry.
Thank you. As you can imagine, there's every day that's, every day before that, and then every day after.
Like, you know, totally. Oh my God,
it's like one of those pivot moments. And my sister, Renee, she was killed in Jacksonville, Florida, in March of that year, in a carjacking gone wrong. And I had to, you know, go back. I had to leave the, I was working on a large investigative piece about the proliferation of gang graffiti and what gang graffiti is dangerous and what isn't. And kind of this long piece that was kind of complex. And I was in the middle of working on this and then had to drop it, obviously, and go back to Florida and identify the body. And then there was an arrest and the trial. And, you know, it was, so I'm sort of fire tested on this. I've seen it from both sides. And the Florida Times Union, which is a newspaper in North Florida, they, you know, they had some mistakes in the first day story about, you know, some of the biographical information was wrong. And then they had made a leap of, they saw an indentation on her car window and they thought that she, you know, it was a bullet hole and it wasn't. Stuff like that. So I can, I know about the sensitivities.
Sure.
From that angle. You know, I ended up covering crime for, you know, 6 years after that happened. And I actually became much more committed to doing it. And I felt, in a strange way, emboldened because I felt like I could walk up to someone and say, I don't know how you feel, but I think I know what you're going through, you know, and feel like I had the credibility to do that, and rarely mentioned my sister. I actually almost never mentioned it. But what I would do is I would go up to people and I would write my pager number in those days on the back of a business card and my home number, and you know, walk up to someone who and say, look, you know, if they just lost a loved one, I would say, you're having an impossible day. There's nothing that I can do to make it better, but I'm going to try to not make it worse. Here's my name. Here's my number. Here's my home number. If you call, I'll just ask you a few questions about this person's life. I talk to the police about this person's death. If you don't call, I won't bother you again. And they almost always called.
Wow. Well, listen, that approach sounds extremely comforting. You know, people probably want resolution and some sort of justice when it comes to that kind of stuff. I'm sure that's probably what you experienced.
They want answers, and or they want you know, the responsible party found, or they want to draw attention to the investigation, or or to lack of investigation, or what have you. And you're right. Our kind of assumption is that people are going to recoil, but often it's not the case. And in fact, I remember after a couple of years of doing that, and really kind of, I mean, I became well known for being a crime reporter at the paper and outside the paper, and really had a strong affinity for it. And I think because of the circumstances that I mentioned, but. I remember I finally took a vacation, and when I came back, I had voicemails from a woman in Santa Ana, and she was furious that I had not written about her son's death. She's like, you wrote about everybody else in this neighborhood when they died. How come my son doesn't get a story?
Oh, wow.
There was also, on the other side of it, I remember doing a ride along with the Santa Ana PD where they kicked in a door and they served some murder warrants. Over on 3rd Street, and when they went inside, one of the cops came back out, and he was grinning, and he waved me over and walked me in while they were, you know, after they took the suspects out. And there was a stack of my stories in this guy's house, you know, because I had written about his gang and stuff, you know.
So they had
clippings. And
how did that make you feel exactly?
Well, I mean... it was a little complicated. I ended up kind of fostering those sources, actually. And there's a park, El Salvador Park in Santa Ana. And I was proud that for a long time, I was like the only guy that wasn't from the neighborhood that could walk through that park and, you know, not get messed with. And I ended up doing a book called Two Badges, TWO Badges. And it's a true crime, true story. Wow. And it's about somebody I met in those days who was grew up in the gang. She was a gang member, a fierce fighter in the gangs, and then got out of the gangs, but also got pregnant as a teenager, married the guy. She's from a traditional Chicano family and Latino tradition, and they married. He turned out to be not a good guy. He was a gangbanger, gang member, and a heroin junkie, which she didn't know. Beat her, beat the kids. She finally escaped him, and then at age 27, put herself through the police academy and to become a police officer in her own hometown. And
that's amazing.
It's an extraordinary story. And Mona is an amazing person. I could tell you the story. It was my first really big front page story. It led to a book, and John, I can even tell you the first paragraph. Would you like to hear it?
Because
I
remember
I remember it so well.
I'm so captivated, and it's such an amazing story. We love to hear some of these, you know, tragedies turned into something positive. My gosh.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. And it is a very positive, inspirational story. And it started, Mona Ruiz carries the weight of two badges. One is the Silver Shield of the Santa Ana Police Department. The other is the gang tattoo that coils down the wrist of her shooting hand. One marks her as a protector on the streets, the other as a former predator. She's walked in both worlds, but she's welcome in neither. This is her story.
Wow, that's good.
Yeah, it's pretty good.
That's really good. And the fact that it's true makes it even better, you know?
Exactly.
Wow, that's really interesting.
First day on the job, her lieutenant, her LT, took her into a back room at the station, and her uniform was so starched it made noise when she walked. Everything was so shiny and new.
Yeah, right.
And he took her to a back room and said, "You belong in the back of a police car, not the front. We never had this conversation, but you will be out of that uniform before I'm out of this one."
Oh my god,
that's her first day.
Yeah, great first day on the job, guys.
Yeah but she turned it around and made a believer of a lot of people, including that guy who later said he regretted saying that.
Well, good for him. At least maybe there's something good out of that.
Yeah, exactly.
What I keep going, you know, as you're telling me these amazing stories and just little anecdotes from here and there, I mean, I can't help, especially with, like, think about your sister. I mean, that's a lot of, like, emotion to take on and to turn into a profession. I mean, how do you, especially after your sister's tragic death, like, how did you manage your emotions that way? Did you just turn it all into work energy, or did you?
Yeah, I did. And I had some editors that were kind of worried about me, you know, because of that. I remember I had one editor say, "We don't want you doing suicide by adventure." He called it, like, you know, put yourself in these places. Mm-hmm. Like, he was worried that I had survivor guilt, like that, you know.
Yeah.
Why am I the one that's here and she's not? And it was tough. It was really tough. And I finally left the beat, and switched over to music because I couldn't take it anymore. And also I became a father. And as soon as my first child was born, who I named after my sister, I did want to come home every night and look down at the crib and just think of all the things that could go wrong.
Yeah, of course.
So I switched over. You know?
Yeah, I mean, I'm not a parent, but I obviously have many close friends who are, and I've tons of young kids in my family, and it really does change the way you kind of look at the world, and especially like in the true crime world. I mean, I can tell you, just doing the show, I look at posting pictures of my young family on social media differently.
Sure.
You know, and all the different things that come along with that. And it sounds like you're managing it pretty well, though. I mean, you've really seemed to turn that tragedy into a lot of positive energy, which what more can you ask for, you know?
It's funny that this conversation would come up because I didn't talk about it for many, many, many years. And I was never able to write about it. The paper would extremely supportive, and they said, you know, I had editors say, you know, if you want, we'll fly you back to Florida. If you want to go to interview this guy in the prison, you know, that's a kind of a complicated thing to get your head around. Like, I would be one of the few murder victim family members that would actually have a chance to go and directly contact the person, you know. But I didn't write about it, and I didn't really deal with the emotional stuff for a long time. But yeah. Recently, as a matter of fact, like last month, I did a podcast. I have this podcast I do, and I had a guest come on. It is Wayne Coyne from the band The Flaming Lips, which is a great rock band.
Oh, yeah.
And he has a new song about something that happened when he was a kid, when he was a teenager, and he almost died. It was a robbery that he was working at a fast food place. And he did a song about it, and I mentioned what I had gone through, and we started talking about my sister, and we talked for like 30 minutes, and it was this huge breakthrough for me. It was the first time I've really ever talked about it outside of family, and certainly in public. And
good for you.
Yeah, and we got a huge response to the episode.
Yeah.
And I mean, Wayne's like, he's texted me all this stuff ever since. We kind of like have kept in touch, and it's an interesting process. And I'll tell you, the weird thing is that it came back in another way last year when the guy that shot my sister was arrested about 8 days later on the same street using the same gun trying to rob somebody else. There was a cop that he didn't see that just nabbed him. And he had a lot stacked against him in that case. My sister was like a United Way official. She was shot in a church parking lot.
I'm so sorry.
And it was also a black and white crime, and that's North Florida, and in that area that you get juries, it's everything's really racially charged.
Right.
So he did a plea bargain, but he had just turned 18 at the time of the plea bargain, and he's still in prison. He had been trying to get another trial based on some aspects of the original case, and succeeded. And earlier this year, he went back to Duval County. He was transferred from his state prison to the county jail to go to the county courthouse for a court appearance. And my family and I were really kind of alarmed by the whole thing that it was going to potentially reopen a lot of this in a different way. The night before his hearing, he murdered his cellmate.
What?
And now he's facing second-degree murder charges on that case. He drowned the guy in the toilet.
Oh, my God.
Yeah, it was a child molester who had been in custody for less than a day.
Wow.
So
how do you hear that news? Like, what do you? It's like on one level, it's like it's like one somebody's dead. Of course, that's horrible and tragic. But at the same time, I'm assuming it sort of put the new trial and the hearing on hold, right? Or canceled?
Yeah.
Like, how exactly?
Yeah, did that play out? That's pretty much off the table now.
I would assume.
Yeah, right? That's off the table, and he's facing this new case, I've learned enough in life that I would never put a value on any,
for sure,
approximate value of anybody's life versus anybody else's. And I don't know the circumstances of what happened in that cell, or I don't know the circumstances of these two men's lives, really. Certainly, one of them I don't know at all, any of the circumstances. So I can't tell you, but I can tell you from my point of view that it's a freaking complicated bundle of emotions.
I can only imagine. My gosh.
And, a weird feeling of relief and a weird feeling of dread. But I would also say, when I was talking to my son about all this, not that long ago, I was saying, I remember going into the courthouse when the trial took place and when this guy entered his plea and everything, but I can't remember him. Like, he's a blank spot. Like, I could see the courtroom, I could see my family, I could see the attorneys, I literally cannot remember the way he looked at all. He's like he's an empty spot.
You think that's your brain kind of like coping and making sure you don't have this extra memory in your head?
They say that's how memory works, is that really painful memories become scarred over, so that we have a hard time, kind of feeling or sensing them. But I don't really know. But I do know that I remember my sister very, very, very well. And for me, the fact that she's still here and he's not a part of my memory feels like the right thing.
Absolutely. Oh my gosh, yeah. We should also mention that although that's a very interesting story, this guy seems to have not been convicted of anything just yet, so wanted to make sure that was clear.
Yeah.
Wow, what a life you've lived, Jeff. I really appreciate you sharing these incredible stories with us. Tell everybody the name of that podcast, by the way, because I have a feeling a lot of our listeners are going to want to hear that.
Oh, well, I hope they enjoy it. It's got a mouthful. We just started, and I'm new at this, but the title is Heavy Metal Magazine presents Jeff Boucher's Mind Space. There so you if know. You... If you have time to type all that up, you can find it. But it's casual conversations about popular culture with good guests. We had the first one is Malcolm McDowell talking about the 50th anniversary of Clockwork Orange, which
That's
is coming
right.
up.
Amazing.
And we had a couple rock bands. We had Flaming Lips and Mastodon and some comic book artists and some TV people. So it's a little bit all over the place, but it's all my pop culture fixations and fascinations.
That's amazing, and it's right up my alley. So I am absolutely, I'm going to become your biggest fan here in about 25 minutes when I subscribe.
Awesome. That's fantastic.
You also had Susan Vega, right?
Yeah.
That's amazing.
Susan Vega, she had done a New York live performance that was released as an album on September 11th. So we did a bonus September 11th episode. And it doesn't really necessarily fit in with the tone, because Heavy Metal Magazine, for people that are of a certain age, you'll remember Heavy Metal Magazine was a comic book for the newsstand. It's not about music. It had like science fiction comics. Some of them kind of raunchy or adult, mature.
<They're> mature. Right, mature.
They're both immature and mature. So, so this is sponsored by those folks. And
cool.
So Suzanne Vega is a little bit outside the normal wheelhouse, but because it's September 11th, we wanted to do something special with show our love for New York.
That's amazing. Where are you based, by the way, right now?
I'm in Los Angeles.
Are you still there?
You know, I grew up in Miami, and I've been out here though ever since college.
Got it. Very cool. Well, Jeff, thank you so much for coming on and telling us these incredible stories. I wish you all the best. You have a lot of history, you know, that you're processing in a very great way. And I really appreciate that you would come on and share such personal experiences with us. It really does mean a lot.
Oh, John, I enjoyed it. And I hope your audience enjoys the Orange County series.
That's right.
Yeah.
And you guys can watch Jeff on The Real Murders of Orange County this Sunday, November 8th at 7 p.m. on Oxygen. And then, of course, check out his very awesome podcast. Jeff, whenever we're, you know, once this COVID stuff is over, we've got to get together in New York or L.A., wherever it may be, and we'll have that martini that we did not have today. Does that sound good?
I will hold you to that.
Very good. Thanks so much for joining us.
Cheers.
Bye-bye.